This is The Scoop, a weekly regional roundup of stories from remote radio stations in British Columbia. Each week, The Scoop features news created by fellow LJI journalists in the communities of Smithers, Prince George, Nanaimo, Burnaby, and the Comox Valley. LJI is the local journalism initiative, and it's how your best local news is funded on these participating stations. Now, let's see what's happening this week in BC.
Today on The Scoop, Justine A. Chambers is an artist, educator, and professor of dance with Simon Fraser University's School of Contemporary Art and the recipient of the 2025 Viva Award. Danny Nesvrandi at CJSF in Burnaby sits down with Chambers about her win. The Weaving Words Festival has emerged annually in Prince George, Clinton today as one of Canada's longest-running Indigenous literary festivals. Ian Gregg at CIFRA Radio reports from the festival. In Nanaimo, a local software developer wants to make buying local produce to support Vancouver Island farmers a lot easier with a new website. Lauren McKenzie at CHLY has more. And a tax increase in Houston, BC has the public asking, do we really need another dog park? Pam Hassan at CACK News reports. I'm Daniel Messick, and you're listening to The Scoop.
Reporting from Vancouver, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. Justine A. Chambers is an artist, educator, and professor of dance with Simon Fraser University's School of Contemporary Arts. According to Chambers' bio, her practice is a collaboration with her Black matrilineal heritage and extends from this continuum and its entanglements with Western contemporary dance and visual arts practices. Recently, Chambers was announced as the winner of the 2025 Viva Award. Established in 1988 by Jack and Doris Shadbolt, the Viva Award is an annual prize awarded to mid-career visual artists in BC who demonstrate exceptional creative ability and commitment to the visual arts. CJSF sat down for a conversation with Chambers to discuss her reaction to receiving the award, her work up until this point, and what's next for her practice and career. To start off the interview, I guess I should just say that I'm here with artist, choreographer, dancer, educator, Justine Chambers, and we're here to talk today about an award that you recently won, the 2025 Viva Award. And the first question that I had for you was just, what was that moment like, I guess, just finding out that you received it in the first place?
I was kind of in shock. Like, it's like my brain wouldn't hear it. Melanie O'Brien called and she said, Justine, you know, I have good news. You're this person. And I went, what? And then she said it again and I went, what? And then my kid came running in from her room and said, Mom, did someone die? And I said, no, it's fine. I won an award. So I was just, I was really shocked. It's not something that was even on my radar as something that I would be, that is available to me. So I was really surprised and delighted, of course. I mean, I think for me, this award, what makes it extra special is that it's a jury of your peers. And that made me feel like a million bucks. Like, it just really, the people on the jury are so such extraordinary humans. And I thought, oh my goodness. And it also made me go, okay, like, no, game on, girl. Now, like, step it up. I think that's always my first response to these things is, like, live up to, if you're just, I feel like when someone, when you're given attention, it's a call to meet that attention and consider what else you could be doing, which, and not in like a strange, not worthy way, because I do feel like I've worked very hard and it's just lovely to be recognized, of course, but I also think, now you keep going, you know? So motivating, shocking, delightful. And yeah, it's very cool. I can't even be cool about it.
Yeah. I mean, that's fair. I like what you said about, you know, it's not that you're surprised in a way of like not feeling worthy of it, but more so that like now you feel like you have to sort of rise to that occasion of
absolutely
of the award. Yeah,
which I love. You know, it's always great to like keep going, like bring the A+ game, you know, or whatever it is, you know. That's I think that's, you know, what we have to do to stay interesting and interested. It's always more interesting to be interested than to be interesting. You know what I mean? But I think like that's it makes me want to grow a little bit, maybe harder than I was planning to or something. Yeah.
One thing I was really interested by was like the wording of the award. When I was looking into it, it said that like the Viva Award was established and is labeled as being a prize awarded to mid-career visual artists in BC. Is that a label that you would agree with or subscribe to? Like, do you see, especially in the context of a career that involves creative expression, do you see your career as having like a fixed start and end?
Oof, that is such, I mean, there's many debates about these things. And I think, you know, if we, you know, I am definitely mid-century at this moment of my life. So in that way, I'm like, you know, assuming that I'll live to 100, then yes, it's mid-career. But then also, yeah, I don't know. It's hard to think about being in the middle of anything, right? You know, like you said, there's this like kind of this sort of protracted continuum that we all feel like we're on. And it may be, you know, I think that that's a really tough question, because like, when are we mid-career, right? And you know, in some places it would be like, oh, if you're no longer emerging, you're mid-career. But yeah, I mean, I just hope that, yeah, I would love for this to be mid-career. I'll put it that way, because I think like, ooh, really, am I going to keep working all the way until I'm 100? But maybe I will, like, who knows, right? But maybe in the realm of visual arts, I'm more mid-career than I am in dance. Maybe that's a better way of putting it if I think about it that way. You know, like I started dancing professionally when I was 18. So I think that, but my sort of, my relationship with visual arts, I think, showed up like in the 2009, 2010. So maybe in that way it is. I mean, it's just even wild to say career at this point in my life. I don't think that I even, when I started to dance, when I decided that I was going to be a dancer, I don't think I could even see, you know, further than 2 years ahead, you know. But then now I can look back over 30 years and go, okay, maybe I did have a career, you know, like I did make it a career somehow. Like, how do we do these things? Because, you know, this never has always, it's, you know, there's so many talented artists everywhere, all over the world, right? And it's not, we don't always have like the right timing or the right opportunities or the right means to keep going. And I guess it makes me maybe in that sort of, now it makes me feel like I'm way past mid-career when I can look back and be like, wow, I had the support to do it. But yeah, mid-career. I also paused when I read that, I will say.
Yeah, because who gets to define that, right? That was something I was very curious about.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's funny because I think about like how granting bodies kind of define that. You know, it's like, are you emerging? Are you mid-career? Are you senior? Sorry about that noise. It's my SFU email. I don't know how to turn off that notification. Maybe that shows me as like a really mid-career. Yeah. So I think that, yeah, maybe those things are defined by our support systems or the structures that allow us to keep going. But for myself, sometimes I feel like I'm just figuring things out now.
Once again, that was our conversation with Justine A. Chambers, the winner of the 2025 Viva Award, meant for mid-career visual artists in BC who demonstrate exceptional creative ability and commitment to the visual arts. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca. Wednesday, March 4th marks the initiation of the Weaving Words Festival, or Utlu Noye Kuni. Morning through evening performances and panels take place. This includes a virtual presentation of Powhatan Macbeth, an indigenized version of Shakespeare's Macbeth. The opening gala at Ominika Arts Center in downtown Prince George Clarity Tene features a stacked lineup, And joining me in the studio today is one of the festival's passionate coordinators, UMBC professor of Canadian Lit and Creative Writing, Dr. Rob Buddy. Thanks so much for joining me, Rob.
And thanks for having me, Ian.
Could you mention a few of the guests at the opening gala and perhaps just a couple authors you're really looking forward to experiencing at the 2026 Weaving Words or Utlu Noyikani Festival?
Sure. So we have two nationally known authors that are coming in. Richard Van Camp, who writes children's books. He writes horror. His most recent novel is called Beast, and it is a beast of a novel. It's great, but he does a lot of work in film and comics, and he's just an energizer bunny. He is Tleet Cho from Fort Smith. He teaches, and he's just so charismatic that you will fall in love with him instantly. Everybody does. Also, this year we have Katharina Vermette from Winnipeg, who is Métis and a novelist and poet. Her most recent book is called Possession. Also, closer to home, we've got a musician formerly known as Saltwater Hank, who goes by Gum Simone, and he will be singing. His most recent album is entirely in the Tsimshian language. And we also have Kim Gucci and Carolyn Roberts, an educator and children's book author. Kim Gucci will be known to most of your listeners as a local superstar.
As I'm familiar with it, the Weaving Words Festival isn't strictly about the written word or authorship. It is about the many different ways in which words form communication or art. And the festival manages to draw on all kinds of artists, authors, and experts in our region of Northern BC, which is fantastic because a lot of people don't necessarily think of Northern BC as having a healthy arts and culture scene, but we do.
We do.
And it's definitely on showcase at this festival. But, you know, maybe it wasn't always like this. You know, 2026 Weaving Words versus the inaugural festival. What has changed? Can you illustrate anything about the origins of this gathering for us? Any history? Maybe you can fill our audience in.
Sure, sure. I mean, the first thing you need to know is that this is the longest running Indigenous literary festival in Canada by a long shot.
Wow.
So,
really?
You know, I don't think we celebrated it enough that we have that here. But yeah, it began in 2005 and it was a collaborative idea. Back then it was called the Aboriginal Storytellers and Writers Festival. And Paul Michelle, who was the director of First Nations at the First Nations Center here at UMBC, and I, he wanted to get Indigenous authors in, and I was bringing Canadian authors, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous, and we said, hey, let's start something. And his interest is in oral storytelling. That's what he did his graduate work in. And so he was interested in orality and traditional storytelling. And a lot of Indigenous authors across the country were also interested in traditional story, but were putting it to the page, either in poetry or in novels or in short stories or in film and all sorts of things. And we said, well, we would like a festival that would explore the conjunction of those two. You know, that traditional oral storytelling that is passed from generation to generation, and then this burgeoning renaissance of Indigenous literature in Canada, where you have Eden Robinson's and, you know, the Wabgishig Rice's, who are bestsellers, right? They're just taking over in a wonderful way, right, the storytelling of the country. So that was the sort of brainchild that Paul and I had, which sounds intimate. And it was. It was, a labor of love. We both really liked what we came up with. And in the first years, we had authors like Thompson Highway, and we had Lee Miracle, and it gained momentum. And yeah, it's just kept that momentum with, you know, an organizing committee that has evolved over the years. And Paul left UNBC, so we had a few lean years where I was sort of holding the fort, but holding space as a non-Indigenous person. And now it's out of the Office of Indigenous Initiatives, and it's Indigenous-led, and I'm just a part of it, and it's wonderful.
It's had quite an evolution over the years. It's taken place for just over 20 years then, and there are certain things people come back for again and again, I imagine, even back to all the way in 2005. But I've got to ask, what's different this time around in 2026? What do you see as different for the festival this year?
Well, every year we have a theme. You know, a few years ago we had a theme of honoring elders. We've had youth themes. This year our theme is land, language, and story. And we decided this year, because we're talking about language, that it was important to have the Daketh version of that. So land, language, and story translate as Yinka Ganek Adada in Daketh. Just like weaving words translates as Atlu Noye Kweni. So honoring the language. So we just had an opening event this morning where we had some experts on the Daketh language speak about the health of the language. And I played a recording of an elder telling a Daketh story all in the language for the first time in 50 years.
Wow.
That traditional story has been told in the Tlaytlay dialect of Daketh. So celebrating that language and its connection to land and story.
I would imagine then that a lot of the focus on material this year is looking at that connection between land and language, the inspiration that comes from that connection. Mm-hmm. Has there been any performances or any material that you've already experienced that you feel was particularly impactful on you so far, one that really drew that theme forward in your mind?
I mean, Marian Erickson, who teaches Daketh here at UMBC, gave a talk on how she teaches the language, especially to children, right, and the ways in which it's transmitted and the ways in which there are certain words in Daketh that can't be translated, that there is no word in English for that Daketh word. And I ran into that as well. I did the four levels of Daketh language here at the university because it's free for faculty to take courses. And I just thought, okay, I needed to know a few words for things around me in the language of the land, right? And ran into, you know, translation problems where it was a concept in Daketh, a worldview in Daketh that isn't in English, right? And so that, you know, it speaks to the importance of language preservation to preserve that worldview, that culture that's embedded in the language.
Thanks so much for sharing some insight on this year's 2026 Weaving Words Festival occurring here in Prince George Clelly Tene. That's also Utlo Noye Kuni. And with us in studio today is Dr. Rob Buddy. Thanks so much for visiting.
Yeah, thank you. Merci.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM.
This is a CIFA News Update. A local software developer wants to make buying local produce to support Vancouver Island farmers a lot easier with a new website.
I want to see people feeling connected to their food again. I want to see people feeling empowered to grow their food, to share their food with their communities, to support each other.
That was Josh Fraser, a software developer and co-founder of the online platform Homegrown. Homegrown is a new online marketplace for local food that helps local farmers, bakers, and makers connect with people wanting to purchase local food items. Fraser and his business partner Michelle Gordon both shared an interest in buying local produce and goods. But after finding how surprisingly hard it would be to buy locally, they came up with an idea.
And I think that's a problem a lot of people have, is how to connect with the community that underpins an area. That was the challenge that I wanted to solve, was make it easy for people to just jump in and see, okay, this is who's selling in my area. You know, these are the farms that are here. These are maybe the new up and coming folks who are just starting out, and I can go buy direct from them, and I don't have to wade through the sea of Google search results that don't really match what I'm looking for to find it.
While many local producers may attend farmers markets, Fraser says this platform allows buyers to know when and what markets they'll be attending and other ways to purchase food or items they produce.
And if you're like me, your life is probably pretty chaotic, and you may not be able to make it to those farmers markets, or you may not be able to plan and buy enough from those markets to fuel your week. And so, like, fundamentally, it's hard to use a farmer's market as your full time, like, this is where my food is coming from. And if you are like me and you want to buy more local food than just once a week, there's not really a whole lot of other options. So that's kind of what we're trying to get at is can we provide some other avenues for people to buy local more than just once a week?
HomeGrow makes it easier for farmers and food producers to sell their goods outside of farmers markets. Sellers will get the chance to list a pickup locations for the buyers to meet them at, whether it's at a commercial kitchen, a farm, or a farmer's market.
So if you're selling out of multiple markets, or say like a market and a farm stand, or you're producing salsa at two different commercial kitchens throughout the week or whatever, you know, these are the ways that we found people were operating. So rather than try to get them to do something else, we built a platform that makes that easy. You list your locations, your customers can see exactly where you are on different days of the week, and they can order from those locations and pick up on those days.
As a regular at the Island Roots Farmers Market that happens from 3 to 6 p.m. every Wednesday at Bevan Park, Fraser says he tries to shop local produce whenever he can. He says this interest first came from wanting to find ways to combat climate change and seeing how climate change could affect the food supply chain to Vancouver Island.
I mean, we all lived through COVID and saw what happened when, how fragile kind of our supply chains can be. These like big industrial beasts that then like fall over as soon as somebody gets a boat stuck in a canal or whatever. So I think a cool thing about homegrown, a cool thing about sort of local food systems is they're a lot harder to disrupt. So, you know, if your neighbor down the street is growing potatoes and sharing them with, you know, your block or your town or something, and a boat gets stuck in a canal or a pandemic hits or whatever, those potatoes are still there. You know, they don't need to be shipped in. Nothing needs to change. You can still get them.
Following a recent pilot program in Squamish, Homegrown is now live for buyers and sellers to sign up and use the platform online. Along with sellers in Squamish, on Vancouver Island, products can now be purchased from producers West Coast Spores in Cowichan Valley and Glasson Farm in Nanaimo. West Coast Spores sells a variety of kits to grow gourmet mushrooms, while Glasson Farms offers forest-pastured pork, grass-fed beef, and a variety of free-range poultry products. Fraser says he also hopes Homegrown becomes a place to showcase alternative and indigenous food systems that aren't normally seen in a typical grocery store.
Indigenous food systems, you know, often go sort of like unseen, even though those are the food systems that are most inherent to where we live. I think there's a lot of opportunity for people to connect with different types of food and different types of people than they maybe otherwise would connect to.
Fraser says while the platform is still in its early days and focusing on getting people from Vancouver Island and Squamish involved, he hopes the platform can be used all over the province so everyone can connect with local food hubs. For CHY News, this is Laura McKenzie.
This is CICK News. The Houston District Council met Tuesday night to tackle budget concerns, infrastructure needs, and community services. I'm sharing with you conversations that delve a little deeper into the BC Emergency Health Services, but as an overall, here are the key decisions that are affecting residents. In the most debated item of the evening, Council approved a 2% property tax increase for 2026, affecting both residential and business properties. This is lower than the original proposed 5% increase. Council acknowledged the economic challenges facing the community following the Canfor mill closure and reduced industrial tax base. One taxpayer spoke during public input, expressing concern that taxes have already risen 21% over the past 2 years.
My taxes went up 21% over the last 2 years, and you guys want to add another 25% over the next 5 years. I'm sure with the Canfor mill shutting down a few years ago, you guys knew that this could come to a head one day, and nothing seems to change. You guys don't mind spending more and more money all the time, right? Do we need a dog park? I really don't think we need to spend money on stuff like that.
Council Overman pushed for 0% increases, arguing 2026 is unique given revenue losses and economic uncertainty. However, Councillor Reitzma cautioned against depleting surplus funds, warning that it could lead to dramatic tax hikes in future years.
Most of the retailers, or just about every retailer I talk to, is hurting big time. Their sales are down. Also, we have to be mindful of Finning Tractor. They're still here in the little office, but they're not there anymore. Monster isn't there anymore. Two small stores in the mall have shut down. We need to think about these things. Like, we can argue all these things, and the surplus is there to make it zero for 2026. And that's what we need to do for 2026. We're not serving our taxpayers well if we if we ask for any increase.
The budget will return for first reading at the next meeting and may still be adjusted. Council approved purchasing a new garbage truck for $427,000 to be financed over 5 years through the Municipal Finance Authority. The current 2016 truck requires excessive repairs that no longer justify keeping it in service. Council also voted to apply for $150,000 from UBCM to update the district's 1998 subdivision and development bylaw. The current bylaw requires infrastructure like streetlights and underground drainage that don't fit Houston's needs. Councilor Riverman and Hogan questioned the high cost.
So as far as I could tell, this bylaw was copy and pasted from a larger center and put into our bylaws, which is why it's not constructed to our needs here in Houston. Why is it going to cost $150,000 to write a new bylaw that says basically the same thing, but with a couple of caveats?
What I hope to do with this bylaw is link up with the master municipal construction documents for design standards and performance standards.
Council received results from a dog park survey showing strong support for maintaining the Paul Gordon Memorial Dog Park year-round. There's also interest in adding a dog park at Jamie Baxter Park. Councillor Mueller strongly opposed adding a third dog park, questioning spending priorities during tough economic times. The item remains in the Jamie Baxter master plans, but has no immediate funding allocated.
I don't know why we're touching this topic. I had a strong opposal of you guys bringing this to the agenda in the first place on touching the Four Seasons Park and looking at building a third dog park, because we already have two dog parks in town. I just don't think that this should be touched at all in regards to, I think I had pretty strong words on it in the beginning, that if it's not broken, why are we fixing it?
The Houston Leisure Facility will see a 3% annual fee adjustment to improve cost recovery. Currently, the facility operates at 14% cost recovery compared to a municipal target of 30%. Fees remain comparable to or below other regional facilities. Council deferred voting on water and sewer fee increases after Councillor Reitzma raised concerns about equity.
If we've done a 12.5% increase to the tied on rates, then there should be a 12.5% increase. I'm not against an increase. I just want everybody's increase to be the same.
The proposal included a 50% increase for hauled water users, while metered users saw no increase. Staff will return with clarification. That's it for this week's Scoop. Catch us next week, Thursdays at 12 p.m. in Smithers, Thursdays at 4 p.m. in Burnaby, Fridays at 8 a.m. in Nanaimo, and weekdays at 7:30 in Prince George. The Scoop was made possible by funding from the Canadian government and the Local Journalism Initiative, a Community Radio Fund of Canada initiative.